This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Okay, the vice president shot a man. On the one hand, this is just a very sad story that anybody, or at least any hunter, could identify with. Hunting buddies out shooting quail, and one shoots the other instead. Not good. Just brush him with birdshot, and it's almost funny in a macho hunter kind of way. For a while yesterday, the White House was joking about it. Trent Lott called Dick Cheney the shooter-in-chief. But when the hunting buddy is 78, and he's hit in the head and chest, and he has a heart attack, not so funny. And when the vice president, the shooter, doesn't call his boss and doesn't say peep for days to the American people, well, that seems odd. Up next on Point, Dick Cheney, the shooting in Texas, and the quail hunt gone wrong. We're going to hear in this hour from hunters and historians from Texas and the nation's capital. Joining me right now from Washington is Ann Kornblut. She's national correspondent for the New York Times. Ann, thanks very much for being with us.
Of course, my pleasure.
And from Austin, Texas, we're joined by Harvey Kronberg. He's writer, editor, and publisher of The Quorum Report, a nonpartisan newsletter focusing on Texas politics and government. Harvey, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We're going to go to the scene in Texas, but first, Ann, to you, there's been just a tremendous kerfuffle in Washington here over the way this has come out. Why is the Washington Press Corps so apparently up in arms?
Kerfuffle, that's the perfect word. Well, you know, everyone, I think, would have been up in arms regardless of how the news came out. But the truth is that the vice president decided not to release an official statement about what happened. And so it came out in the local paper in Texas where the incident occurred. The hostess of the ranch called her local paper and alerted them to what had occurred. And the rest of us didn't find out until the following day. And I know this will actually be part of the joke for, you know, some time to come, that the White House press corps is so offended that we didn't get told first. But even Ari Fleischer, the former press secretary, said that there are some incidents that rise to the level of warranting some kind of official statement. He believed this was one of them, and yet the vice president chose not to.
And your own paper reporting today that yesterday, when Scott McClellan came out in the morning wearing an orange tie and joking about how he wanted to avoid a stray shot from Vice President Dick Cheney, he was joking because the vice president's office had not, at that point, informed him of what they then knew, that Harry Whittington, the poor 78-year-old attorney, had a heart attack, was in trouble.
Had taken a turn for the worse. That's correct. And then at the noon briefing, Scott McClellan also knew that it had gotten, he had taken a turn for the worse and did not divulge that. His reasoning being that was really the right of the hospital in Texas to say so. This has been a very difficult couple days for the White House, to say the least.
To say the least, a difficult week for the vice president, no doubt, and certainly for his hunting partner there, who took the bird shot. Harvey Kronberg, we're going to look at what's going on in Washington, but take us into Texas. I wish you'd first just give us a flavor here. I mean, this is in a way a piece of Americana, Texicana anyway. Take us to the ranch. What's the setting here? Is this how Texas politics is done?
Well, first of all, the Armstrong Ranch is kind of an icon in terms of Republican politics, and the people that were there that day, you could more or less describe as kind of the pioneers of the Texas Republican Party. Some of them were operating mimeograph machines back in the 1970s when I think it was the 1972 or 74 Republican primary produced exactly 65,000 or so voters.
A different day than from now. Yeah.
And it was long before there was a real Republican Party. The Armstrong Ranch is kind of a rite of passage. It's just old establishment. The hunting area is very rudimentary, very comfortable. Carl Rove goes there frequently when he's in Texas for bird hunting. Bird hunting is kind of like golf in a lot of other states, or just hunting in general. It's a rite of passage. It's historically been male bonding, although that's less and less the case. These days, you don't have to be male to be a good old boy in Texas politics. And you may recall that back in 1994, when George Bush was running against Ann Richards, we had Ann Richards out there bird hunting to show that she was pro-gun. And And, of course, George Bush at the time accidentally killed an endangered species, a killdee, which created a small little scandal. But it's such a part of Texas' fabric that one of the reasons that George Bush was able to beat Ann Richards, believe it or not, was because the folks in East Texas thought that her pro-environmental stance was going to impact their ability to take their hunting dogs down to the lake and go hunting.
And it's part of the culture right there. Here, a 50,000-acre spread 60 miles south of Corpus Christi, so that's way down south. My brother's in Dallas, and I was talking this morning. I mean, he's part of that culture now. People go dove hunting, they go quail hunting. I grew up with hunters. Nobody wants to see someone get shot, especially, well, I shouldn't say especially, but this was very ritzy company that the vice president was in.
Absolutely. Harry Whittington. Well, in some ways, this is kind of like the, this may sound a little strange, but it's the Republican Party aristocracy. These aren't traditional social conservatives. We used to call them country club Republicans, very genteel types of folks. They've been fighting these battles for a long time, and now they've kind of arrived, and they're not social conservative types. They're more economic conservative types, more traditional Republican. And I'll tell you that members of the legislature routinely go on these little bird hunting trips into Mexico or into South Texas. It's incredibly commonplace. We've got legislators that have turkey shoots with season up in the panhandle as part of their fundraising operations. So,
and Texas, of course, I mean, Dick Cheney's a Wyoming boy, born and raised, but Texas has been good to him. The former governor there making him vice president. He became CEO of Halliburton out of Texas, made $40 million in 5 years there, and that was, as I recall, the mother of his host at the Armstrong Ranch was on the Halliburton board that hired him. Is that right?
I believe that is correct. Ann Armstrong, well, the Armstrong family is, has been a centerpiece of Republican politics. I mean, they've been ambassadors to the Court of St. James, have a long history of you know, high honors, I guess you would put it in, but it's part of this interlocking directorate thing of her being on the Halliburton board. Was probably just to add a prestigious name to it, but not sure how much direct input she ever
just
had.
Just part of that circle, high honors, also high access. So reading here reports that Catherine Armstrong, whose family owns the ranch, who's been fairly open about the whole incident there, who I guess was out with Dick Cheney and Harry Whittington and the rest, has been a paid lobbyist to lobby the White House. She's been paid plenty, Harvey, for access. She says not to Dick Cheney or the president, but certainly to White House officials over the years.
Well, I can tell you there's a whole slew of folks here in Texas that get their calls returned from the White House. Most cases, I don't think they're specifically lobbying the president or Karl Rove, who's obviously part of this circle. But they get their calls returned from staffers up and down the food chain, and they can get things done with a well-placed phone call.
$160,000 to her in 2004 for reaching into the White House. Not bad for some phone calls. And
that really isn't uncommon in terms of the fees that these folks charge.
We're going to look more at the hunting and exactly what happened there. But Anna, I want you to help us with the kind of, I mean, in a way, this is becoming very rapidly some kind of allegory about Dick Cheney's secretiveness, his privateness. This is a vice president extremely determined not to say anything he doesn't want to say to anybody.
Oh, the allegory and the symbolism. Yeah, everyone has the sort of instantly pounced on this. It's true. He does not believe he has been a big, and actually he's been very open about his belief in the powers of the presidency and the belief that the executive should not be required to divulge as much as some in the past had done. And there's actually TV footage. I saw some on CNN yesterday that was replayed from him from some black tie dinner talking about his own secretiveness. In more candid moments, people around him would say, yeah, that's what he believes in. He does not believe that the public needs to know every nut and bolt of his life.
But what about the president? He didn't even call the president of the United States. Is that because they're so close that he knows that George W. Bush would understand a hunting accident? This is a Texan? Or is there something out of line here in the kind of chain of command? I mean, you would think the VP would be on the phone to the president right away saying, here's what happened.
Well, I would say there's the rub. I mean, certainly he did not call the president. I cannot begin to describe motives to that. But there were numerous people within the White House, well, within the administration, who felt that that was a mistake. But less even that he didn't call the president, that he did not allow his staff to coordinate with the White House staff to handle this in a way that would diffuse it quickly. It's now Wednesday and we're still talking about it. This, you know, happened on Saturday, and there were some who believed that they could have dealt with this quickly on Saturday, Sunday, gotten it over with and done with.
Marlon Fitzwater, the former White House Republican spokesman for this president's father, George Bush Sr., saying Dick Cheney has ignored his responsibility to the American people. Are Republicans flying to his defense in Washington, Ann?
To an extent. I mean, I would say it's not really a political issue. I believe today have Trent Lott quoted as sort of teasing the vice president when he was up on Capitol Hill yesterday. I mean, it's very difficult for anyone to defend the fact that the vice president shot a 78-year-old lawyer. But there are plenty of hunters who have said this happens all the time, and certainly the members of the hunting party have given their account, saying that they believe that Mr. Whittington was at fault. So no one is sort of accusing the vice president of anything criminal at this point. It's mostly been treated like a joke.
The humor meter has gone up and down on this as Harry Whittington's health has hung in the balance. The White House making jokes yesterday, and a lot of other jokes as well. Let's just get a feeling before we turn back to the seriousness of the shooting, but about how that humor is playing out. Here's what Dave Letterman, Jay Leno, and Jon Stewart dealing with the incident.
Now, this thing, we talked about it a little earlier. Dick Cheney goes down to Texas with a gun and starts shooting people.
In fact, when people found out he shot a lawyer, his popularity now 92%.
But it's Valentine's Day, and I hope you folks are having a lovely Valentine's Day, and everybody is in the Valentine's mood. For example, earlier today, Dick Cheney shot his buddy in the ass with an arrow. There you go.
I'm joined now by our own vice presidential firearms mishap analyst, Rob Corddry. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
How is the vice president handling it?
John, tonight the vice president is standing by his decision to shoot Harry Whittington. Now, according to the best intelligence available, there were quail hidden in the brush. Everyone believed at the time there were quail in the brush. And while the quail turned out to be a 78-year-old man, even knowing that today, Mr. Cheney insists he still would have shot Mr. Whittington in the face.
America's jokemeisters Letterman and Leno and Jon Stewart going to work on the hunting accident in Texas. Of course, it's funny until it's not. Lots of people joking yesterday. Trent Lott and the president's own brother and the White House presidential spokesman. But then Harry Whittington's health is a real issue here, and that is not funny. We're joined right now from Comstock, Texas, by Andy Funk. He's a hunting guide and going to take us into the brush a little bit to describe what may have happened here and what he makes of it. Mr. Funk, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, how are you?
We're well. And for our listeners who aren't quail hunters, we'd be very grateful if you'd just kind of give us the basics here of how this hunting unfolds and how you understand what happened on the Armstrong Ranch.
Well, basically, there's several ways to do it. I understand from what I've heard and read that they were on foot and had already flushed a covey of quail,
mm-hmm.
and that Mr. Whittington had gone on to retrieve one. And while he's doing that, I think that Mr. Cheney was following up on the covey and the other hunter also,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Whittington was coming up behind them. Well, if they reflushed a covey, what happens is a lot of times you focus in and concentrate on the bird that you're trying to shoot,
mm-hmm.
okay, and human nature, you end up getting tunnel vision and start excluding things from the vision because you're focused on that bird, and it's fairly simple to not see the background because you're focused in on that. These things happen periodically. This is bad because it involved a hospitalization.
Absolutely, and one of those pellets migrating toward the heart. Describe, if you can, for us, Andy Funk, the cover here on the Armstrong Ranch. Is this tall grass? Is this brush? What's it like?
I'm guessing from the times I've been in the area, I've never been on the ranch, that mm-hmm. it's probably a grass-type thing with maybe some motts of trees and things in the area, because that's your typical quail habitat. And it's fairly simple. If there's any brush in the area, if somebody's coming up behind you and the bird flushes backwards or so, to you know, not be aware that there's somebody there. It's you should look, but in the heat of the moment or the chase, it's not impossible for something like that to happen.
I was talking this morning with my brother in Dallas, who does some dove hunting down that way, and occasionally quail. I mean, of course, when the covey comes up, it can be a lot, a dozen, even 20, and I guess the hunter's object is to focus in on one, not just to blast into the middle of the covey if he hopes to bag one. Is that right?
That's correct, because if you just blast into the middle of the covey or the flock of doves, you know, then you're probably just, you know, wasting your time. So you focus in on that bird, and, you know, you have to do the lead with the shotgun and
mm-hmm,
all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen and witnessed these things, and I've had the pellets come by me.
Yep. Dick Cheney was using a 28-gauge shotgun. That's kind of a fancy shotgun, isn't it? What does it mean to be using a 28-gauge?
A 28-gauge is a lot smaller than what most people are, I guess, accustomed to, the 12-gauge and the 16s and things like that. But it shoots a slightly tighter pattern. But it's still, you know, expels projectiles at a high rate of speed.
Mm. Now, ducks don't like orange, and Dick Cheney had some fun with John Kerry when he was goose hunting in orange. But quail don't mind. Is it? Do you presume that these guys would have on, you know, the bright orange hunting gear?
Well, it's not required in the state, and it's probably a neutral thing. I've on quail hunts, I wear it, okay,
mm-hmm.
just because of the possibility of an incident like this. But it's not required, and I really don't think that it matters to the quail one way or another.
And how, as a hunter, how do you process this? I was talking to a brother-in-law this morning who's a big hunter and a serious shot, and he said, you know, if this had happened to him, he's not sure he could go quail hunting again. His remorse would be such. That it could shake a hunter's nerve or just make him want to walk away from it. This wasn't just a light peppering. It appears more serious than that. How does a hunter process a shooting of a hunting partner like this, Mr. Funk?
I'm not sure how someone else would process it, but I'm sure Mr. Cheney is, you know, very remorseful, devastated or whatever. I would be, and I think, you know, anybody else would be, because you don't ever want to, you know, hurt somebody accidentally or intentionally while you're out there for a good time. You know, that's the last thing that anybody would want.
How often does this happen, a serious wounding of one hunter by another in quail hunting?
A serious thing? I wouldn't have any idea, but I would guess that it on quail hunts, it's probably possible, you know, on a fairly routine basis. I've seen it happen on dove hunts where the people can actually see each other and their area is fairly clear. There's, you know, no intervening brush and things like that. It just, this a serious thing like that, I think you'd have to refer to Parks and Wildlife's records on it and things like that. But it's not unknown at all. You know, this is not really out of line.
The birds go up and the guns go off. We've got some questions for you, Mr. Funk. Kevin's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Good day. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm a hunter from Maryland and wondering why more is not being made of the fact that the vice president was poaching.
What do you mean he was poaching?
He was hunting quail without an upland game stamp. If I were caught by a fish and wildlife officer in Maryland hunting deer without a proper stamp, there would be serious consequences for me.
Andy Funk, it was a $7 stamp. The vice president apparently didn't have it. He said it was just a kind of a staff oversight. Is that a big deal to you?
No, the staff should have been more diligent in, you know, following up what was necessary. And I don't know how they made arrangements for him to get the out-of-state license. We have had people get their out-of-state licenses from stores and things like that, and this would be for deer hunting, and they get the 5-day thing that entitles them for exotics and doesn't include big game. So, I mean, mistakes can be made administratively that is really nobody's fault, neither, you know, Mr. Cheney's or his staff.
Get the $7 stamp and get it in there, but Kevin says they would have been on his tail in Maryland. Andy Funk, hunting guide in Comstock, Texas, we're very grateful to you for speaking with us. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Harvey Kronberg in Austin, how do you think this is going to go down in Texas? Does it raise the vice president's standing to be in a hunting dust-up or people shaking their heads? How do you see it?
Well, I spoke to a number of Republican types yesterday, both consultants, operatives, and that type of thing, folks who had actually been on routinely on bird hunts, and there was a lot of eye-rolling. In a funny way, it diminishes him. One Republican political consultant who's been running campaigns for years and is an avid bird hunter says the absolute rule is that before you fire your weapon, you absolutely know where every dog and guy is. And that when these act, he got peppered once as a ricochet, and it took him a long time to, and that literally was an accident. It just bounced off a tree and hit him in the neck. But it takes a while before people will hunt with you again, simply because they don't trust your judgment. And in a lot of ways, this is something that people understand. It certainly. Folks are dismissing it as to a certain degree as an accident, but among the hunters I speak to, it really diminishes the vice president that he didn't know where everybody was before he fired.
And then others asking, why didn't he talk about it? Ann Korblut, I want to bring this back into your court with a little tape, if I may, from the press turning up the heat yesterday at the White House at the daily press briefing. Let's just get a sense of the tension there. Here is NBC's David Gregory pushing White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan.
I'm not getting answers here, Scott, and I'm trying to be forthright with you, but don't tell me that you're giving us complete answers when you're not actually answering the question, because everybody knows what is an answer and what is not an answer.
And the final, David, now you want to make this about you, and it's not about you. It's about what happened, and that's what I'm trying to, and I'm trying to provide answers to the questions.
And McClellan shot back, ending the briefing with this barb at the press corps.
If you all want to continue to focus on this, you all can spend your time on it. We're going to keep focusing on the pressing priorities of the American people.
And take us further into what it is that is keeping the press on this. I mean, at one level, it's obvious. The vice president shoots a man. That's kind of like, holy smokes. On the other, there is a kind of anger we can hear in these interactions. I wish you'd interpret for us.
I mean, I have to laugh listening to that clip you played. It sounds like a couple in a very bad relationship.
Yes.
A couple has been together way too long. And you also, there was a part that you didn't play where David said to Scott, don't be a jerk. Look, I mean, in some ways it's true. The group that's in the White House press briefing room has been in there now through a lot. They've been in there, some of them through 9/11. Almost everyone through the Iraq War, through, at least one election, if not two. And over time, there's been, I think it's fair to say, an erosion of trust, not with Scott personally, per se, but with the White House in general.
And the vice president in particular, or no?
Maybe that's fair to say. It's hard to say because the vice president doesn't have somebody who stands at the podium and answers in an official way. But sort of overall, there's been this erosion, and at the same time, the briefing is televised, and a lot of you will notice it's normally the TV folks who raise the biggest stink in front of the cameras. But I think there's actually a very substantive frustration beneath that of not being told things in a timely way, not being told the entire truth, and really sort of feeling angry that the White House doesn't feel that they need to do that.
And this isn't just any vice president. We had, U.S. News and World Report reporting. I mean, Lawrence Wilkerson, former chief of staff of former Secretary of State Colin Powell, saying the real president of the United States is Dick Cheney. I mean, the White House pushes back, but this is a very powerful vice president. I want to turn now, if I may, to Amherst, Massachusetts, and historian Joseph Ellis. He's professor of history at Mount Holyoke College, author of His Excellency George Washington. He won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Founding Brothers, the Revolutionary Generation. Professor Ellis, thanks for being with us.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, take us back, way back, if you would, to the last time a sitting vice president shot a man.
You have to go way back. You have to go back to July 11th, 1804, when Aaron Burr, then sitting vice president under President Jefferson, shot Alexander Hamilton, and eventually Hamilton died in a famous duel, probably the most famous duel in American history. It was quite different from anything that Mr. Cheney has just done. It was obviously an accident in the case of Mr. Cheney. This duel was highly intentional, and Burr shot Hamilton in the left side, and the bullet ricocheted off his rib into his spinal column, and he died the next day.
What were they fighting about?
They had been opponents and antagonists for years, though they had been friends as fellow officers in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, which is where they both internalized a very high definition of honor, of personal honor, taking affront to any kind of criticism that seemed to be a question of character. And they had fought each other politically in New York and at the national level. And when Burr was on the ticket in 1800 and the electoral votes were equal between Burr and Jefferson and had to go to the Congress, to the House of Representatives, to break the tie, Hamilton actively campaigned against Burr for Jefferson's election, even though he hated Jefferson.
And what happened to Vice President Burr after he killed a man, and not just any man, but a high official, Alexander Hamilton?
Well, it was against the law to fight a duel in New Jersey or New York, and he fled the law and eventually went down to South Carolina, but shortly after reappeared in the Capitol, which was Washington, D.C., newly created Capitol, and oversaw sessions of the Senate, as was his responsibility. But his political career was killed by this episode. He was not reelected, and the rest of his career is a series of escapades in the Southwest.
Professor Ellis, thanks for being with us. Joseph Ellis, professor of history at Mount Holyoke College, author of His Excellency George Washington. Right now, Matthew's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My point that I wanted to make, and I think the reason why they're making such a big deal, or the press is making such a big deal out of this, is that if they had come forward in a more timely matter, a more immediate manner, it keeps them clear of even, like, the hint of impropriety. And I don't mean impropriety like possibly he had shot him on purpose or anything like that, but just that something has happened with the vice president, and we're letting the public know about it. I mean, this is something that if the gentleman's health gets better, it would have blown over, except for 24 hours goes by before the press corps even knows about this. And these are smart men, okay? These are not bumbling idiots.
So you're saying they should have just stood up right away, made the phone call, here's what happened, it's the vice president, so it's news, it needs to be public, and things would have been better.
I'd say without a doubt. You know, and the reason why is because it seems like the culture in Washington itself, especially with this administration, is giving, you know, providing sparse facts, if providing any information at all about things. And so people that are on the outside looking in see this in relation of a larger context. It's not necessarily related specifically to what's going on with Jack Abramoff or what's going on with the war in Iraq, but there is a underlying sense that it could be connected, because if this person can't be forthright about something like this, again, where the gentleman, you know, his health has taken a turn for the worse, but if he gets better, could have been a minor incident in, you know, the great timeline of history.
Could have.
Now, you know, it's a major thing, and with his health, you know, a little bit, I guess,
yes, it's been dicey recently, and we hear how it's coming to you, the kind of cloud around it. Matthew, thanks for your call. I want to turn to Dallas, Texas, and our friend there, William McKenzie. He's an editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill McKenzie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You hear the caller from Iowa saying, gee whiz, why didn't he just come straight out right away, say here's what happened? He's the vice president, after all. We get sort of minute-to-minute reports on things much less than a vice president shooting a man. How's that going down to your mind?
Well, I agree with the caller. I think he's dead on. I couldn't say any better. They should have just come out and said what they knew earlier on, and they could have avoided problems they are having now. However, I think that the press has also looked really, if I may say so, childish in the way they kind of had the bloodletting the other day with Scott McClellan the first day after it. Even the Daily Show spoofed the press last night for, you know, having fangs and just looking for blood. I mean, the guy got shot. It is bad. It is a story. The White House didn't let on what they knew. Let's go on.
What about, I mean, our caller in Iowa says, you know, it resonates because there's been a lot of secrecy here. And what about that line of thinking?
Well, sure. And I'm not defending that. I think the White House should tell more. I think Cheney should have said more about the energy task force he had. And we wrote a lot of editorials to that effect. But I think, you know, this response by the press is, I don't think it's really about the shooting. It's about their frustration with secrecy in the White House. And I understand that. But I don't think we in the press help our cause when we spend 30 minutes on CNN and C-SPAN and other cable shows picking apart every little point of this.
On the other hand, it's not every day, in whatever circumstance, that the vice president shoots a man. It's been 202 years. But Ann Kornblut, it was an accident. What do you say to this kind of implication that the press is just way overboard here?
Argue the case either way. I mean, certainly the White House has pleaded that it's an accident. Can we please move on? You know, on the other hand, I think Bill's right that this is symptomatic of a larger question. I think it's not just an expression of this incident, but there's a sort of a longer history of the press combating this White House over just the most minor details and some really important ones, I think, stemming primarily from the war in Iraq. I would say that the question from the caller in Iowa is really relevant and interesting because it's always the cover up that's the problem. I mean, this is not specific to this administration. It's not the incident itself. It's the cover up. It goes back decades. It was the primary lesson of the Clinton years that you should just put it all out there instantly and get it. And yet, no administration seems to understand that lesson. It's never without fail that this is the case.
And this is not just in the administration. This is an unusual vice president with no presidential ambitions himself, unusually close. His old friend, Bob Michaels, congressman from Illinois, quoted in the Washington Post saying today, that Cheney has enclosed his personal feelings so tightly to showing them in public. Michael saying, I guess that discipline upon himself is probably the thing that holds him back. He's virtually immune to public criticism and image problems. I don't think he really cares, says Bob Michael now, but maybe should a little more. Bill's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Couple of points I wanted to make. I think that anybody, my family owns quail hunting land in South Carolina. We've hunted for generations, and everybody who is a good hunter knows that in this case, it's Mr. Cheney's fault. There have been attempts, I think, even earlier on your show to say that the guy who was shot is sort of taking the blame and saying that he was in the wrong.
Well, the White House has suggested that he went out to get the quail. He came back without announcing he was coming back, so he'd broken protocol.
That is just not the way it works. And anybody who's a gentleman hunter knows that if you're the guy shooting the gun, you are absolutely, unquestionably responsible for knowing where your hunting party is. And this is in quail hunting is 99% of the time in semi-open territory. If it's not, you need to know. If you can't see the person, you're not supposed to shoot. If you know he's out there, like you should, you're not supposed to shoot.
And what about, we heard earlier from our hunting guide, Andy Funk, you know, the quail go up, it's kind of an explosion of the covey, and you get tunnel vision around that one bird you're focused on. It's still the vice president's responsibility, in your view?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're hunting with somebody who's not going to take responsibility for shooting the gun that can kill somebody, well, I don't want to be hunting with them, and it's ungentlemanly. I think the bigger point to me is that Mr. Cheney, and I'm sure that he's been great to the family of the guy that got shot.
There's news that he's spoken with them and he's sent his prayers and best wishes, yes?
Well, of course, but I mean, why isn't the guy, if he's vice president of the United States, why isn't he a big enough gentleman to stand up and look in the American people's eye and say, it was an accident, I take responsibility, I was in the wrong, and you can look in his eyes and tell whether he's sincere about that. And finally, the other issue is about this hunting stamp, and each state probably has a little bit different system for that. Your earlier caller was right. If I did that and didn't have a stamp, they would castigate you. And secondly, I remember George Bush Sr. wrote an article that I read in one of the quail hunting magazines years ago in which the issue was accidentally shooting, I think it was a sparrowhawk, which flies very much like a dove. And First President Bush was a real gentleman about it. He said, you know what, if you do that, whether you're caught by the game warden or not, your responsibility is to turn yourself in and to pay the fine and admit that you did it wrong.
Nothing private about it. Make it public. Bill, let me ask you, you sound pretty well informed here. This is just a question from the outside, but what about, I mean, here we have the Vice President, Dick Cheney, who's had a lot of very well-publicized heart problems, pacemaker and all the rest, and Mr. Whittington, 78 years old. Should these guys be hunting?
I suspect they may have been walking, but I don't imagine guys at that age are doing anything at a breakneck pace. So, and they probably have Jeeps close by. I think those Texas ranches are typically very, very big, and they treat you pretty well when you're hunting out there. It's not like you have to go out and fight it out all day long. Mm. It's a pretty high cotton hunting, as they would say.
But stand up, you say, be a gentleman and make a clean breast of it. Bill, thank you for your call. William McKenzie in Dallas, how about it?
I don't have a problem with that.
Is the Vice President a prisoner of pride here, of disdain for the press or the public's right to know?
You know, I can only guess, and it may be all three, and I just don't. I would defer to Ann on that since she's around the Vice President more than I am, but I would guess it'd be a combination of all three. The only thing, and I'm not here to defend what they did because I think they should have come out at some point Saturday evening and said, look, the Vice President shot somebody. The only thing that perhaps you could understand why they didn't is that they didn't know the condition of Mr. Whittington at that moment, and they were either waiting for a better read on his condition or didn't want to get ahead of his family for some reason. And I don't know if that's the case.
That's the only reason I can understand
delaying the
information. I have to say that's not an explanation in particular that I've read anywhere.
They've said that they were concerned about the details and they didn't want to release anything, but it's pretty clear this was not a decision that was made by the sort of press officials. I mean, certainly it was not made by Scott McClellan, who didn't know that the Vice President had been the shooter until the next morning. This was a decision that was made on the ground by the Vice President himself. And we will not know unless he decides at some point to talk about it publicly what his motives were.
Let me another call here. Jeff is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're good. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, you know, it's an accident, and it's, you know, it's too bad. I'm sure Cheney feels badly, but I think it's more of a lightning rod for everybody to grab onto with their frustration with Cheney because he's so secretive and sort of seen as the man behind the president, and he won't, again, you know, he's not coming clean, and I think that's where the frustration comes from with the press.
It's just the stonewall once again, and the press is tired of it. We got it, Jeff. Let me take another call here,
okay,
if I may. Mary is calling from Acton. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. It's actually Mark.
Doesn't sound like Mark. Mark, I'm Mary. Mark, welcome.
Hi. I think the real story here is clear if you just do a thought experiment. Let's imagine that it's Vice President Quayle we're talking about. We're not having this conversation.
What do you mean exactly?
What I mean is the point you alluded to earlier. George, and I want to say the name no one has said, George W. Bush could get to the bottom of this and solve everyone's frustration. He alone can tell the Vice President to break his secrecy, just as he and he alone could have found out who on his staff leaked Valerie Plame's name, and just as he and he alone could have made changes in the CIA if he truly believed he were misled. I think the press's frustration here is that there's no accountability for George W. Bush. He has managed to pull off an amazing feat. He has made himself effectively the head of state to whom all loyalty is owed. He's like the cheerleader-in-chief, and Vice President Cheney is the prime minister. All mistakes, all shortcomings go downstream, despite the fact that George W. Bush is constitutionally responsible.
So you want the president on the horn to the vice president saying, let's get this all out in the open right now. Mark, let us look at that. And a couple of questions raised there. First is, I guess, could he, in fact, just call the vice president and do that? And some people are writing in the last day or so here that this relationship between the staffs of these two men, at least, is not perfect. The vice president is not running for office again. He feels beholden maybe to no one.
Well, certainly, as you said, the relationship between the staffs, I would say it's not really even the staffs. I mean, it's a pretty seamless staff in some ways. But the White House, sort of the underlying pillars in the White House, don't feel that they can control what happens from the vice president's office. I mean, of course the president could call Cheney and ask him what happened. They've been alone, I mean, or they've at least been in the same room.
The White House, the Washington Post today is saying that even high-level White House aides are reluctant to take on the vice president's office. What's the dynamic there?
Well, I mean, they certainly feel that Cheney runs his own shop. But I think more to the caller's point is that the president doesn't feel comfortable taking him on. The one encounter that we've had described to us between the president and the vice president since this all occurred, they were in the Oval Office when Kofi Annan was there, and they were joking about it. This was, of course, before Mr. Whittington's health took a turn for the worse. But the president has not ever been sort of in charge of this relationship. If anything, although they're almost the same age, he's deferred to the vice president, and we see that here.
Harvey Kronberg, the other side of that question is, would he want to push the vice president forward, or is it possible the president's an old Texan? Might he just agree with Dick Cheney? This is nobody's business but the Armstrong Ranch and the family there, and Dick Cheney, he was on his own time. It's nobody's business but Dick's.
That's probably one of the instincts, but I can tell you that we all know how political this White House is, and the problem they're facing, I think, has been illustrated by a number of your callers, and that is people don't always understand all the intricacies of big policy questions, but this really goes to a question of character of the vice president, and eventually they're going to realize, I think, that this is something human that folks can actually relate to. And it diminishes the vice president, and it creates, I think, down the road, it's going to create some political liability, not directly, but just adding to the frustration. The majority of people don't believe the president right now, according to every poll that I've seen, and I think that this, in many ways, reinforces that perception, and it puts it in a real human dimension.
Bill McKenzie in Dallas, the strong, silent VP showing his strength again, or the strong, silent guy, you know, going too far here, indifferent to public perception. How do you see it?
Well, I'm probably more in the camp that he looks, you know, indifferent. I think he would help his own cause and that of the president by doing what that caller said earlier and just saying, you know, I made a mistake and go on. But I also want to come back to two points. One is, I don't think this is the federal case it's being made out to be. I mean, the guy shot somebody. As a kid, I hunted, and I remember spraying a friend and had other friends. Well, another friend got shot. I'm not dismissing it, but stuff like this happens.
Head and chest, hospital, heart attack.
Sure, but it wasn't, as we know, intentional.
Yeah,
it was
of course,
a hunting accident. But here's what the other second point is, and I think the White House really needs to look at, why is this resonating so much? Why is there so much anger? Why is there so much frustration? And I don't think it has a thing to do with the shooting. It has to do with a larger frustration with administration. And I think that's something they need to pay attention to.
Do you think Dick Cheney cares?
You know, I don't know how to answer that question. I guess, defer to people who are around the vice president all the time. I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, I guess actions will, in some degree, speak for themselves here. It's been great speaking with all three of you. William McKenzie with the Dallas Morning News in Texas, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Harvey Kronberg, writer, editor, and publisher of the Quorum Report, joining us from Austin, Texas. Mr. Kronberg, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Tom.
Ann Kornblut, national correspondent for the New York Times. Ann, always good talking with you. Thanks for
being
with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.